Good to see everyone tonight. We're going to begin in the New Testament, though we will be making our way to the Old shortly. If you would turn in your Bibles to Luke chapter 21. I'd like to start there tonight. Sure appreciate everyone that's continued to make their way out this week. I know a full week is a lot of commitment. You're here every night. I know you have a lot going on during the week. And yet you still have come. And I keep taking you back to the Old Testament, which sometimes can be a little bit burdensome or tiresome for some. But you all have just been really good students and participants, and I know you've been here to worship. If you're visiting with us for the first time, this series that we're doing, I've called Old Testament Images of New Covenant People. Another way to say that is what we're trying to do in this study is find our purpose as Christians from the past, but not the first century Christians' history, but the things that they would have thought about, the things that would have motivated them, what the prophets and what the characters of the Old Testament would have taught them about who they were in Christ. And so we've just been taking some time to do that this week. Tonight's lesson is going to be a little different than some of the stuff we've been doing in Isaiah. We're going to study just one character. But to introduce that character, look here in Luke 21. And I want to show you something that I want to get better at, that Jesus was very good at. Verse 1 of chapter 21 says, "And he looked up and saw the rich putting their gifts into the treasury. And he saw a poor widow putting in two small copper coins. And he said, 'Truly I say to you, this poor widow put in more than all of them. For they all out of their surplus put into the offering, but she out of her poverty put in all that she had to live on.' And while some were talking about the temple, that it was adorned with beautiful stones and votive gifts, he said, 'As for these things which you are looking at, the days will come in which there will not be left one stone upon another, which will not be torn down.'" Notice verse 6. When Jesus says, "As for these things you're looking at," and contrast that with verse 1 and 2, and notice what Jesus was looking at. If you have this scene in your mind, you've got Jesus with his apostles in the temple complex, and they're paying attention to all the gold and the flashy things and the big things that they're impressed with, and he's watching what people do. And specifically, he's watching what a widow does that probably not anybody else noticed. You know, preachers come and go. I've heard a lot of great preachers. By the way, I've heard of this congregation before, but the reason that I heard of it is because I'd heard the name Mike Grushon. And I've enjoyed getting to know Mike. But one of the things that I need to learn to do better in my life is to see the powerful examples of people that go unnoticed, people that aren't as well known. Some of you have already shown me some of that this week, people that I would have never known who have difficult stories, but you're faithful to God, and that's an encouragement to me. The reason I use this to introduce the story from the Old Testament is the character we're going to talk about is overshadowed by bigger characters in the story. We're going to talk about a woman named Abigail in 1 Samuel 25, if you turn back there in your Bibles. And though I think there are a lot of women who know Abigail's story, because Abigail gets studied by women when they do a study women of the Bible kind of thing. But a lot of people don't know Abigail as well because she is overshadowed by people like David and Samuel and others in the story that are bigger characters. But there's a reason why God told the stories that he told. There's a reason why God let us know for a whole chapter about what happened with Abigail and David on this occasion. And I'd like for you to just be thinking about some of those things as we look at this beautiful woman together. 1 Samuel 25, verse 1. "Then Samuel died, and all Israel gathered together and mourned for him, and buried him at his house in Ramah. And David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran." Now David has been fleeing from Saul for some time now. We studied some of that earlier this week. He had been crowned the king back in chapter 16 he'd become famous because of Goliath and his other battles with the Philistines. People were beginning to know who he was. But David was in exile, and he's running all around, you know, trying to keep away from Saul. So now we find him down in the wilderness of Paran. Let's go to verse 2. Now there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel, and the man was very rich, and he had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. And it came about that while he was shearing his sheep in Carmel, now the man's name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail, and the woman was intelligent and beautiful in appearance, but the man was harsh and evil in his dealings, and he was a Calebite. I want you to notice verse 3 is a parenthetical. So verse 3 introduces us to the characters, but if you go from verse 2 to verse 4, you get the sense of this. The end of verse 2, it came about while he was shearing his sheep in Carmel, verse 4, that David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. So David sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, go up to Carmel, visit Nabal, and greet him in my name. Stop there. We'll talk about what David has his young men say in a moment. All right. So we're introduced to some characters. Nabal, Abigail, and David. We know David. Nabal is described as very rich. I guess that's right. I don't know how to measure people's, you know, bank accounts by sheep, but this does. I was at Boyd's house, and you have how many sheep? 4 sheep. Nabal's got 3,000. So that'll just give you some perspective. I don't have any, just for what it's worth. But he's got a lot of sheep. He's very rich. It describes Nabal as harsh and evil in his dealings. We'll find out later in the story that Nabal's name means fool. And I don't know if his parents named him that or if he just had such a reputation that that's what he became known by. But this is not a very good man. But Abigail, on the other hand, if you look at verse 3, is described as intelligent and beautiful in appearance. Now, I'll tell you, from the time I was very young, that verse always jumped out at me. I don't know if you guys remember this, men, but weren't you always looking for that? And I'm sure everybody in the room found it, you know, the whole package, beautiful and intelligent. But I can't tell you how many women I met that were beautiful, and I thought, wow, look at her. And then you'd have a conversation with her, and you'd think, well, at least you're beautiful, you know, like, that's all right. And then there were the girls you could talk to all day long, and you just were enamored with their mind, but you just, you know, you wish they looked like Abigail. Abigail's described as the whole package. She is the dream girl of the Bible. In fact, if I could go back and pick any of the Bible women, it'd be her, or maybe Abishag, but it never says anything about whether she was smart. So this is the people in the story. Now, verse 4, Nabal is shearing his sheep. Now, this would have been in the springtime after the winter coats had been put on the sheep up in the mountains. It would have been a festive time when the shepherds would bring the sheep back down. They would shear them. They would get all the wool. They would kill some of the food. It would be a really great time. David hears that this is happening, and so he sends some of his young men down there, and here's what he has them say. Look at verse 5. So David sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, go up to Carmel, visit Nabal, and greet him in my name. And thus you shall say, have a long life. Peace be to you, and peace be to your house, and peace be to all that you have. Now I have heard that you have shearers. Now your shepherds have been with us, and we have not insulted them, nor have they missed anything all the days they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we have come on a festive day. Please, give whatever you find at hand to your servants and to your son, David. Now, David has men with him. You remember a couple nights ago, we talked about David, when he had fled after he went to Achish, king of Gath, and he'd gone to the cave of Adullam, that many people gathered to him, 400 men that were in debt and in distress and discontented. Remember David's 3D army. And the foreshadowing of the rightful king of Israel, unrecognized, nobody else follows him except these kind of losers, is a lot like what would happen with the son of David hundreds of years later. But David's army of 400 had grown to 600 by this time. And now he's got a lot of people with him. And he's been in the wilderness, it sounds like, policing the area. Like making sure that none of the foreign armies come or anybody comes, rustlers and you know cattle stealers. And he's guarding people's things in the wilderness, just trying to do whatever good he can. And so he sends some of these young men to Nabal and says, "We've been taking care of your men, and we've been trying to help you out. Please give us some of the spoils of what you have on this festive day." David may be asking for some sort of reimbursement or payment for his good deeds. But another thing David would have been doing is asking Nabal to obey the law. You remember that the law of Moses made provision that for the rich, whenever they would do the things they would do, they had to be thoughtful of the poor and those that didn't have, and that they had to leave the corners of their fields open for the poor. So David isn't asking for anything crazy here. But notice that David specifies there in verse 5 to greet Nabal in his name. You see that? You remember David was famous by this point. He wasn't just famous in Israel, he was famous internationally. When he would go to the Philistines, they'd heard, you know, the top chart songs in Israel about David and Saul. Everybody knew who David was. So when David sends these young men and says, "Greet him in my name," this is something very important. All right, let's look at verse 9. "When David's young men came, they spoke to Nabal according to all these words in David's name. Then they waited." Can you picture that? These guys ride up, they find Nabal, they say, "Nabal, we come in the name of David, blessed be you, peace be to your house," and say all kinds of great things, and they make this statement. And Nabal makes them wait. Have you ever asked somebody a question, or tried to get somebody's attention, and they just didn't acknowledge you? You ever seen that? You ever had that happen? That's awkward. The Bible doesn't tell us if that was 30 seconds, if that was 30 minutes, if that was 6 hours. If I'm reading it right, I think that the reason the Bible would tell us they waited is there would have been this awkward sort of time where these guys looked at each other and Nabal went about his business and just wouldn't say a word to them. Indicative of his character. When he finally does speak, listen to what he says. Verse 10. "Nabal answered David's servants and said, 'Who is David? And who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants today who are each breaking away from his master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I've slaughtered for my shearers and give it to men whose origin I do not know?' So David's young men retraced their way and went back, and they came and told according to all these words. And David said to his men, 'Each of you gird on his sword.' So each man girded on his sword, and David also girded on his sword. And about 400 men went up behind David, while 200 stayed with the baggage." When Nabal says, "Who is David?" I don't think he means, "I've never heard of him." I think what he means is, "Who is he to me? Why are you coming in his name when I've heard about him? I have no respect for David." We'll find out that Nabal knew later, because Abigail's going to say some things to David that prove that he's known by this family. But when Nabal says, "Who's David to me?" And then he makes this comment to these men and says something like this: "There's all kinds of people running around this wilderness who are in debt and owe somebody something, who've made a mess of their lives. They're breaking away from their masters. And you think that I'm going to take my money, my bread, my water, and give it to some guys whose origin I don't know?" Let me ask you something about that. Do you blame Nabal there? Or does that sound reasonable to you? What would you do? If somebody came up to you and you knew the reputation of these guys was that they were in debt and distressed and discontented with life, and they'd run away from wherever they were to live in the wilderness, and now they're asking for your help. Surely every Christian would say, "I'm willing to help," right? Because Jesus said, "Give to him who asks of you, expecting nothing in return." Or does this story start to make you a little bit uncomfortable? How many times have you thought, or even said, or heard somebody say, you expect me to take my money that I worked hard for and give it to somebody who's gotten themselves into this mess? Because most people are in their mess because they made mistakes. I just want you to remember, anytime that scenario presents itself again, that there is a spirit of Nabal and that there is a spirit of Jesus. And those are two totally different spirits. But Nabal says, get lost. And when they get back and tell David, it's like an Old West movie a little bit, isn't it? Guys, saddle up. Get on your swords. Let's go. 200 stay with the baggage. 400 guys who have been insulted take off towards Nabal's house. And I just like the way the Bible tells stories. When I was a kid, there was a cartoon on television called The Justice League. Did anybody watch that when they were kids? And I loved the way that the Justice League told stories. They'd follow a superhero and they'd tell a story. And then they'd say something like this. Meanwhile, back at the Hall of Justice. And then they'd tell like another story in a different place. The Bible did that before that show. Like, look at verse 14. It tells us what's happening with David and his guys to get the dramatic effect. And then it zooms back to Abigail's house. And here's what takes place back at Abigail's house. Verse 14. But one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, behold, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, and he scorned them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we were not insulted, nor did we miss anything as long as we went about with them while we were in the fields. They were a wall to us both by night and by day, all the time we were with them tending the sheep. Now therefore, know and consider what you should do. For evil is plotted against our master and against all his household. And he is such a worthless man that no one can speak to him. How bad a guy did Nabal have to be that servants in the house could go to the wife and say, he's such a worthless man. In fact, some versions actually call him a scoundrel, doesn't it? Does anybody's version call him a scoundrel there? He's such a scoundrel, the guy says to his wife, that we can't even talk to the guy. And there's no argument from Abigail. There isn't a rebuke. Hey, you shouldn't talk like that about him. It's just so well known what a jerk Nabal is that everybody can talk like this. And this says something about Abigail as well, doesn't it? There's a big problem in the family. Who do you go to for help? You go to Abigail. And by the way, I've seen that in families. Haven't you? People know where to go when there's a problem. And too often, men, our children are running to our wives because the confidence they have in them to be wise is something they've not necessarily gained in us. And this story troubles me for that reason. But notice the way that the servant talks to Abigail. Know and consider what you should do. She's wise. She's intelligent. She can come up with some sort of plan here. I want you to stop in the story. We're going to make a couple of applications, then we'll keep going in the story. There's a few lessons I'd like to for us to consider. First thing, I'm struck by the contrast between Abigail and Nabal. Aren't you? Isn't that a strange couple? That's an odd couple. You've got Abigail, who is sweet and intelligent and spiritually minded and wonderful. And you've got Nabal, who's a first-rate jerk. Have you ever seen that couple before? I have. I'm sure you have. You meet the lady, and she is sweet and kind and spiritually minded. And then you meet her husband, and he's just a cranky old man who's just mean to everybody. Have you ever seen the opposite of that? I know some good Christian men who are gentlemen, kind and generous and very wonderful. And then you meet their wife, and they're mean as a snake, and you just don't want to be anywhere near them. How does that happen? How did Abigail and Nabal happen? I want you to consider three options. Number one, when they got married, they both were not very nice people. Sometimes people get married, and they're just not God-fearing, and they're just selfish, but they get married because they're in love. But they're not really people who think of others. They just wanted this person because they wanted this person. And somewhere along the line in this marriage, somebody decides to serve God. Maybe that's what happened. Abigail decided she was going to be God-fearing, and Nabal just would never come along. She did what she did, and Nabal stayed exactly where he was. Have you ever seen that couple? When they got married, they weren't Christians. Somebody became a Christian, really put their life into the Lord, and the other person never followed. That's a difficult life, isn't it? There's a lot of challenges that people have. That's one scenario. Here's the other scenario. Maybe they were both godly when they met. Maybe Nabal started out well, and Abigail and him started by both serving God. And at some point, Nabal said, you know what, that's not for me anymore. I'm out. You know, my business is more important. And he just got worse while she got better. Have you ever seen that? Two people get married who are Christians. And at some point, one of them says, I'm done. I'm out. Is that an easy life? Now, let me give you the third scenario, which is probably the most probable, is that this was maybe an arranged marriage, like it would have been maybe back then. And that Abigail's parents made a grave mistake by allowing their beautiful young lady to marry this man. Now, whichever the scenario is, here's what I appreciate about Abigail. She stays with him. Have you ever seen somebody who thought like this? I didn't sign on for this. Like, when I got married to this person, I expected them to either stay the way they were going to, or get better with me, or follow me on my way. Or maybe I didn't even choose this. It just sort of happened because the circumstances forced us into this. And at some point in their life, they thought to themselves, I need out of this. I have a right to be different than this. Know and consider what you should do. God doesn't measure strength the way people do now. I have always appreciated people who lived in situations that were excruciatingly difficult because they loved the Lord. And it didn't matter what it cost them. When I was a boy growing up in San Diego, there was a family across the street. Tom and Linda were their names. Tom was a very successful contractor. He had big businesses, and Linda was a sweet lady. But at some point, Linda began to have physical problems. She began to not see very well, and then she ended up in a wheelchair, and she just went downhill very quickly. I think she had muscular dystrophy. I don't remember for sure. And as she was getting sicker, Tommy and Monica, the two kids that were their kids, we used to play with them every day. And I noticed that Tommy and Monica both began to trip and stumble and have trouble, and then they had trouble with their eyesight, and they couldn't ride a two-wheel bike, they had to ride a three-wheel bike. And then we were playing softball with a beeping softball so they could find it because they couldn't see it. And they followed the same path as their mom. They all got sick. And I remember one day when I was a kid, I woke up and Tom, the dad, was gone. He just disappeared. To his credit, he let them live in the house. And her parents came and took care of those three precious people until they all died. But I'll never forget this. Because I was a boy who lived at home with a sick mom. And my dad continued to care for her. When Tom would show up every once in a while, because he still owned the house, he had a big fancy new truck. And a beautiful new young wife. And I hated that man. In my little heart, I just thought, how could you do this? How could you leave them? And he would try to talk to me, and I didn't want to look at him. Because that's the way the world works, you know? Unless you belong to the Lord. And if you belong to the Lord, it doesn't matter what your circumstance. You do what's right. When the servant says to Abigail, know and consider what you should do. Women, do you think she was smart enough to think something like this? My, God works in mysterious ways. I think it's time to go visit my sister. Think about it. All you got to do is take a little vacation. And your husband has dug his own grave. And you'll be delivered from this situation. You don't think that went through her head? I almost want her to do it. You know, say to all the servants that you like, hey, servants, I got to take a trip. Let's all go. And just move on and go on. And let God deal with this man and you be free of him, Abigail. I've seen Christians in difficult marriages really step back from their spouse and almost push their spouse to a place so they could just find the excuse to get out of that thing. And Abigail doesn't do it. Look what she does do. Let's go to the next verse. Verse 18, that Abigail hurried and took 200 loaves of bread and 2 jugs of wine and 5 sheep already prepared and 5 measures of roasted grain and 100 clusters of raisins and 200 cakes of figs and loaded them on donkeys. And she said to her men, go on before me. Behold, I'm coming after you. But she did not tell her husband Nabal. Stop there. Notice in verse 18, Abigail hurried to do it. No questioning, no debating. She just started moving. The other thing that's impressive is how prepared she is. Now, I understand it's a festive time. I get that. But you know, in the New Testament, in the book of Titus, Christians are told in the book of Titus to be ready for every good deed. You ever read that verse in Titus? To be ready for every good deed. Do you know any women like that? I mean, they've so prepared their home and their family and their finances that they've thought about, what would I do if a scenario arose where I needed to be hospitable or take care of somebody? And when it happens, they're there. Abigail did that before there were freezers, and, you know, before there was any way to prepare. She just was a woman who thought like that. And she's kind of like my grandma. If there's a problem with men, the first thing you do is you start cooking. And if you start cooking, you're going to be fine because, you know, good food soothes the savage beast. So, notice here, she sends the food ahead in verse 20. It came about as she was riding on her donkey and coming down by the hidden part of the mountain. That behold, David and his men were coming down toward her, so she met them. Now David had said, surely in vain I have guarded all that this man has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him, and he's returned me evil for good. May God do so to the enemies of David, and more also if by morning I leave as much as one male of any who belong to him. When Abigail saw David, she hurried and dismounted from her donkey and fell on her face before David and bowed herself to the ground. Women, I just have a question about that. Do you think Abigail was frightened by this? 400 men, most of whom are from pretty rough backgrounds, one of whom has killed more people and shed more blood than just about anybody you've ever heard of. 10,000s. In fact, he's so bloody with his hands that God won't even let the man build the temple at some point. And you alone come up and get off your donkey and you lay down flat in the dirt in front of him. Do you think she thought that could have been the end for her? Remember Proverbs 31? Proverbs 31, the woman whose worth is far above rubies. Remember her? My favorite verse in that whole text is, the heart of her husband safely trusts in her. One of the greatest things I think that I would have loved about Abigail, if she was my wife, I would have never worried that she wasn't going to do me anything but good, even when I was a jerk, even when I was the problem. That she wouldn't deliver herself, she wouldn't take an opportunity to stab me in the back, that she would actually put her life on the line for me. What a tremendous woman this is. Now, listen to what she says to David in the next few verses, and notice the humility of this woman. Verse 24, she fell at his feet and said, on me alone, my Lord, be the blame. And please, let your maidservant speak to you, and listen to the words of your maidservant. Please, do not let my Lord pay attention to this worthless man, Nabal. For as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your maidservant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. Now therefore, my Lord, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, since the Lord has restrained you from shedding blood and from avenging yourself by your own hand, "Now then, let your enemies and those who seek evil against my lord be as Nabal. Now let this gift which your maidservant has brought to my lord be given to the young men who accompany my lord. Please, forgive the transgression of your maidservant. For the Lord will certainly make for my lord an enduring house, because my lord is fighting the battles of the Lord. And evil will not be found in you all your days. Should anyone rise up to pursue you and to seek your life, then the life of my lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living with the Lord your God. But the lives of your enemies he will sling out as from the hollow of a sling. And when the Lord does for my lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you, and appoints you ruler over Israel, this will not cause grief or a troubled heart to my lord, both by having shed blood without cause and by my lord having avenged himself. When the Lord deals well with my lord, then remember your maidservant." If you analyze that speech that she gave in the dirt, there's a bunch of things about it that are fascinating. Number one, how often she refers to herself as the maidservant of David. And how often she talks about the Lord above, and how often she refers to David as Lord. All of that is good. But did you know that in this text that we just read, we have a type of Christ? Long before Christ came, Abigail was like him. Look again at verse 24. She said, "On me alone, my Lord, be the blame." Do you see that? I don't like that. In fact, if I was watching the movie and I was watching what was going down, I would have said, "No, no, no, don't do that. That's not your fault. You didn't do anything here. You let him pay for his own stuff. You don't take the blame, Abigail." Now, if that's not good enough, look at what she says in verse 28. "Please forgive the transgression of your maidservant." What transgression? What has Abigail done that's sinful? You know what godly people have always known? Is that true love means becoming somebody's advocate. Being the person who goes between somebody and their harm. And she's doing that in two directions. She is stepping between David and her husband and saying, you let me take whatever's coming to him. And she's also stepping in front of David and the Lord and saying, "David, you don't want to do this thing. Because if you do this thing, God's going to judge you for it. And God's got good plans for you. And as much as I'm taking my life into my own hands for my husband, I'm taking my life into my own hands for you." Abigail is fascinating to me. What kind of character did she have to think like that? Look at David's reaction in verse 32. David said to Abigail, "Blessed be the Lord God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. And blessed be your discernment. And blessed be you who've kept me this day from bloodshed and from avenging myself by my own hand." Who does David bless in verse 32? Did you catch it? Blessed be who? The Lord God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. Do you guys see that language? Did you notice anywhere in the story where God appeared to Abigail and said, "Abigail, go"? Did you catch it? Is it just not revealed to us that God appeared to Abigail in a dream and said, "Abigail, get up and go save your husband"? I don't think that that happened. What I think happened is that Abigail had the heart to do the right thing. And when somebody who has the heart to do the right thing does the right thing, it's right for us to say something like this. "Blessed be the Lord God who sent you this day to meet me." Now, I know we get afraid of talking like that because some of our denominational friends say things like that, and we don't want to be misunderstood, right? But did you know that's the right thing to say? Anytime anybody does anything right, the one who gets the ultimate credit for that is God. Here you are tonight. "Blessed be the Lord God who sent you this day to hear me." And that's right. You know why that's right? It's because you didn't come up with this on your own. It wasn't your idea. You learned some things from the Lord. You've read His Word, and you know what's right, and you know what's true, and you know what's good for you. And so you act upon it. I just think we need to get better at connecting all the good things that we see to the God who gave them, and get them in the right order. He says, blessed be God, and He does say, blessed be you. And He's thankful because she's kept Him from shedding innocent blood. You know, the Bible teaches this principle in Proverbs 27. As iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens the countenance of his friend. Can I just point something out about Abigail in this story? She is the only one in the whole story that's doing the right thing. There's not one other person doing the right thing. Her husband's not doing it. The king of Israel's not doing it. Have you ever seen somebody that was trying to stand on their own and do the right thing, and they just looked around them, especially at the people that were supposed to be in leadership, maybe in a church or in a family, and they say, well, nobody else is doing the right thing, so I'm off the hook. Folks, if there's just one person in a time where the government or the eldership or the father or whatever it is that ought to be the person doing the right thing, if there's ever just one person, as meager as their attempts are, tries to stand for the truth and do what is right, it will always have an impact. And you have no idea who it's going to affect. And I love that about Abigail. Skip down to verse 36. Let's read what David says. Verse 34. I don't want to skip this. Nevertheless, as the Lord God of Israel lives, who has restrained me from harming you, unless you had come quickly to meet me, surely there would have not been left to Nabal until the morning light as much as one male. So David received from her hand what she had brought him and said to her, go up to your house in peace. See, I have listened to you and granted your request. Then Abigail came to Nabal, and behold, he was holding a feast in his house like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. So she did not tell him anything at all until the morning light. But in the morning, when the wine had gone out of Nabal, his wife told him these things. And his heart died within him, so that he became as a stone. About 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. I learned a lesson in this. Abigail gets home that night. It's been a long day. You think, you know, from the time the servant came and told her what was going on, and all the preparations, and all the sending of the food, and all the going out, and laying in the dirt, and all the fear of maybe having her head chopped off, and getting all the way back from that adrenaline-pumping day, she looks over at her husband, and he's drunk again. You know what most women would have done? They'd have walked up to the drunk, slapped him in the back of the head, and said, do you know what I did for you again? But Abigail goes to bed. I learned this in this story. Doing the right thing is reward enough for somebody who does the right thing. Some of you are the kind of people that have lived your whole lives serving a spouse or a family or maybe even a church, who've never really said thank you. And we need to do better about saying thank you. But if nobody ever does, I hope you sleep well at night, knowing that God sees it. Now when she wakes up the next day, she goes ahead and tells him. And I don't know what to make of this, by the way. Abigail did not take the opportunity to have her husband killed. But something about whatever Abigail tells him makes his heart die within him. I don't know if it's embarrassment or shame or fear. I don't know what it is that makes him this happen to him. But the Bible specifically says that God took his life. That God killed him 10 days later. Now this sermon is not to say that God's going to like rub your spouse out if they're not a good spouse. That's not what the point of this lesson is. But I do want to make a lesson out of this. If you are Nabal in this story, you need to be very afraid. God's paying attention to your hard-heartedness, your unkindness. God's paying attention to what you do in your family and the neglect. And even if they won't leave, even if they won't seek vengeance, one of these days, you're going to have to pay for it. Or you could see it for what it's worth and realize that what God's trying to accomplish with you by giving you this wonderful spouse, the wife, the husband, or the kids, or the parents that you have and you're not responding to them, the reason that God gave you this is to eventually win your heart. There's another proverb that I want to share with you. Proverbs 13. Verse 12. A hope deferred makes the heart sick, but desire fulfilled is a tree of life. I love this proverb. A hope deferred, meaning you really hope for something. You really want something. Oh, Abigail probably hoped that Nabal would change, that Nabal would get it, that he would finally come around. And as the days turned into weeks and months and maybe years, and the hope became more deferred and more elusive, there's no way around it making your heart sick. I know some of you are sick about some of your family that you love. Your kids haven't obeyed, or your kids have rebelled, or your spouse, or your father, or your mother, or whoever. I mean, it's been years for you. And that hope that you have that they're going to figure it out is just making your heart sick. But God says to people like you, don't give up. Be an Abigail. You keep doing it. 1 Peter 3:1 says to those wives married to men like that, you may win them without a word. You keep doing what you're doing. By the way, have you ever seen it happen? I have. One of our best Christians up in Minnesota is Dave Weiniger. He's a doctor. He was married to Vicki Weiniger for decades and just didn't believe in God. He was just too smart for that. You know, he knew enough about biology and science and all of his doctor stuff to be certain that there was no God. Except Vicki loved him and served him and raised their boys to be good young men. And one day, Dave just couldn't take it anymore. And he came to the Lord. And I know this about Vicki. The hope deferred for her made her heart sick. But the desire fulfilled for her, you should see her. She's radiant about it. It's a tree of life. This verse, by the way, can be used for lots of things. I'll tell you how it affects me and my wife. When we got married, she'd been told that she might not ever have children. She told me that before we got married, and I said, that's all right, you know, we'll figure it out. And so we got married, and no children, and no children, and no children, and a few years went by, and my wife just always hoped for it, you know? And month to month, it would be the same thing. Maybe this month, and then she'd be devastated. And during that time, we had friends who would get pregnant like for the 15th time, you know. And they'd like just keep popping kids out. And by the way, we got to be careful how we talk to each other. Because I'll never forget some of my friends who kept having kids. They'd say, oh man, I'm pregnant again. We're pregnant again. We're having another kid. And I'd go home and we'd lay our heads on our pillows at night and we'd cry and we'd say, God, why do you keep giving them to people that don't want them? Like, we'll take them. That hope deferred made my heart sick. But if you guys ever get a chance to see me with my boys, who God finally graciously helped us have, they are a tree of life to me. Can you think of a lot of ways that we might apply that? Now, Abigail's story is a little different because Nabal never changes. God finally does take his life. Look what happens in the story next. Verse 39. When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, blessed be the Lord who has pleaded the cause of my reproach from the hand of Nabal and has kept back his servant from evil. The Lord has also returned the evil doing of Nabal on his own head. Then David sent a proposal to Abigail to take her as his wife. When the servants of David came to Abigail at Carmel, they spoke to her, saying, "David has sent us to you to take you as his wife." She arose and bowed with her face to the ground and said, "Behold, your maidservant is a maid to wash the feet of my Lord's servants." You know what the Bible teaches? The Bible teaches that if we will be faithful to God, no matter our circumstance, that no matter what the pressure is to quit, no matter what the pressure is to give in, no matter what the pressure is to act like everybody else would act, that if we sacrificially so serve God our whole life, someday we'll also marry a king. And that's how Abigail's story ends. She marries a king. I'll never forget a friend of mine in San Diego. They went to church. Not the same congregation I did, but a congregation across town. And this girl had trouble. She, fairly young, started getting into drugs. And I came to find out that her parents, who went to church, a rather large congregation, so they could kind of sneak in and sneak out a lot, the dad used to buy this girl drugs. And so even though she was a drug addict, her dad was helping her with her drug habit. And this girl got pregnant, and her dad paid for an abortion. And then she got pregnant again, and her dad paid for another abortion. And this girl just was being wrecked by this hypocrite of a dad. And the mom knew about all of that and didn't know what to do. I mean, it was a tough family. They were new Christians. It was a difficult situation. And one day, this father just didn't wake up. Like, he just died one night. And I'll never forget the funeral. When the preacher got up to talk about this man, he told the story of Nabal. And he said, everybody knew this guy was a Nabal. And God's going to deal with it someday. And that made an impact on me as a young man. Number one, I guess when you preach somebody's funeral, you can be really honest. They're dead. But the other thing that it made me realize for the rest of my life is that we really do serve a God who pays attention. God's paying attention to all of us. Who are we going to be here? What are we going to do? This is not just a story about a woman in the Old Testament. This is a story about everyone who will ever serve the Lord. It's your story, no matter what your circumstance. Thanks for your attention tonight. We're going to sing a song. It's meant to encourage you. If you've not become a Christian or you need help from this group with prayer, please let us know how we can help you tonight while we stand and sing together.